Welcome to Power Players by Origis, critical thinking to deliver the promise of clean energy. This program brings you leading voices in solar and energy storage and sectors impacting renewables, exploring challenges and solutions for industry growth, the true cost of operating and maintaining power plants, and system asset management considerations. My name is Josh Corbett. I welcome you to this episode, hosted by Michael Iman, Managing Director of Origis Services. All right, today on Power Players, we have Jason Kaminsky, CEO of Kilowatt Hour Analytics. Hey, Jason, and welcome to Power Players.
Mike, thank you so much for having me. Looking forward to the conversation.
Listen, Jason, for those of us who are listening or watching who maybe haven't worked with Kilowatt Hour Analytics, can you just give a quick, like, who are you and what do you do?
Sure. Good starting point. So KWH is a data-driven risk analysis firm that has in the last couple of years moved into the insurance segment. So we now use data and data-driven insights and underwriting to write specialty insurance products, both on the production side of the equation, as well as the physical asset side of the equation, and sort of bridge the gap between solar asset owners and their brokers, and then carriers on the other end.
So you guys work across sort of the chain to help people allocate risk and figure out what the cost of that is, right, in order to manage risk. Is that a simplified, dumb guy way to say that?
No, that's right. So my background pre-KWH, if I reach back about 15 years ago, is at Wells Fargo in the project finance group. So I was underwriting tax equity deals for the bank. And in project finance, it's like project finance 101, the first day of your grad school class, which actually I took a class in grad school, is project finance, is risk identification and risk allocation. And that's basically the thrust, if you sort of understand that concept, that's the thrust of project finance. What often gets overlooked is the role that insurance can play in that. So the most common role that insurance has historically played is on property casualty insurance, right? Slips and falls, fire, flood, hail, those types of risks. And so we bridged that gap. As I learned more about insurance, I'm a solar guy by training, but as I've learned more about insurance, there's a lot of parallels between structured finance, project finance that you see within banks and the way that insurance gets done. So it's been a very easy transition in some respects to take everything I sort of known about the world and the way risk is structured and using insurance as another form of capital for risk allocation.
So let's talk a little bit about risk allocation, because I think it's become a much more complicated sort of dynamic than it used to be. My sort of mental image of risk allocation is there's like this game of squeeze the toothpaste, and a lot of people are grabbing it, trying to push it to one side or the other. They're trying to push it to the O&M. They're trying to push it to the offtaker. They're trying to push it to, you know, the developer, and they're trying to push it to whoever's buying it. So talk about the role of risk allocation in those change of ownership transactions, and also in the operations phase. Like how do you guys see that?
Yeah, that's good. We used to talk about a balloon, maybe a different analogy, that like you'd push sort of one side of it and something
like
else
the clown balloon,
sort of deform. Not a clown balloon, but like you try to take care of one risk and something over here sort of deform.
Like and even the balloon, you're like problem. It's a chihuahua. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we weren't. Yeah, the bankers were the clowns that were sort of making the balloons in the background. let me think about your question.
Allocation in the transactions.
Within a transaction, there's obviously different players that could wear different risks, right? So you have the asset owner, I'll call it the true equity, that in theory should see the upside when things go really well. You have the lenders and the tax equity, all sort of bunch them together as the downside risk participants, right? They have a capped upside and things, they only see a problem if things go wrong. You have third party providers. I'll put me and you kind of in the same bucket, Mike. You have an O&M provider, you have a service provider, you maybe have an insurance carrier. Someone's getting paid to do a service and you're getting paid to do a real service. You're like going out there and, you know, managing the equipment. And as part of that, they might push some risk onto you. We're getting paid primarily to take some of the risk, right? That's the service that we provide. And a lot of the art is, how do you identify who can control that the best, that risk the best, who has the balance sheet to support that and is willing to do it at a price that makes sense. And I think what we've seen over time, like the industry's gotten smarter in some respects, you know, risks are changing all the time. That's the thing about, I love about solar is I've been in it 16 years and the risks never seem to stay constant. If it's not, one thing, it's something else, you know, and in the property side of the business, the things that we're seeing the most are now like thinner glass panels and hail exposed regions. Like that wasn't an issue 5 years ago. So now we got to figure out how to manage that.
And the issues that we used to have years ago now are on fire on a regular basis. Don't forget that. Now, like that's a new one.
You know, and then on the on the physical, I sort of divide the world into reliability, which is the asset going to work and perform to its expectations, and then resilience, which is going to stand up to some of the physical hazards that it's being exposed to. And there's sort of this interesting trend we're seeing right now. I've spent a lot of time talking to you, Mike, at conferences, on panels and on other sort of podcasts and publications we put out, talking about production forecasting, the fact that often these assets are not actually performing to their expectations. As a company, we put out a lot of research, that sort of data-driven research, one of which is the annual solar risk assessment.
By the way, that's a great, that is, for anybody listening, I want to say the solar asset, say it again, the solar asset
solar risk resource, assessment.
Solar risk assessment, sorry, is a fantastic read. I absolutely read it every year, and I very much appreciate that you guys put that out. It is a good document, so thank you for that.
Well, thank you. I've actually been like approached by professors that are like, this is on my syllabus, and we make our students read it, so who knows where some of this research ends up. But in there, you know, we published that assets on the whole, on average, have underperformed about 8% a year. So like pretty dramatic.
Southeast region, which is the biggest delta typically.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And we're seeing, I think 2024 is maybe a year of change. I'm hopeful for the best. For really two reasons, I'll say. One is, and they're related. I think one is with the emergence of the production tax credit. You know, if you're the CEO saying, do I take a production tax credit for solar? Do I take the investment tax credit for solar? One's based off the amount of money I spend on the project. The other's based off the production of the asset. If I'm overestimating by 8% the amount of revenue or the amount of production tax credits that'll be generated, I can make a grossly wrong decision that is going to have long-term impacts on the viability of that asset. So a little bit more, I'll call it executive governance maybe is on the one hand. And then on the other, we're seeing the independent engineers and some of the folks that are, you know, supporting the third-party validations of these estimates do a lot more validation of their own. So actually ICF published in last year's solar risk assessment that they were adjusting their availability. We just did a webinar with DNV saying that they're doing the same for 2024. So hopefully, I'll call it right-sizing the forecast, that we're really having them reflect what's going to happen on the ground. Which should be on the whole a very positive outcome for the industry. Just as we grow and mature, and like sometimes I have to pinch myself. I've been doing this 15 years and we're like still at the early part of the knee of the curve of growth. There's a lot of solar still to build.
I totally agree. There is a ton left to build. And I do think it's a positive thing for the industry. Like, you know, we have to be able to hit the numbers we're given. We have to fulfill the promises that we make, right? And so that I think is important. But we also need to service the debt ratios and things that we have against these projects, right? In order for them to continue to sort of be viable, right? That's kind of key. So, you know, kind of going from there, how do you view, you know, that risk allocation progressing from this point forward? Do you see things changing in how that's done today and who's going to take what? I know I talk to owners all the time who yearn for the performance guarantees of the past, but that was a great example of where the risk was allocated on exactly the wrong party and probably won't come back. So how do you view it going forward? Where's it moving towards?
It's a good question. I'll make one more comment based off something that you sort of touched on, and then I'll answer that question. But I think the third factor that's probably driving some of the right sizing of production forecasting as well as interest rates, like the equity cares a lot more about their returns than they used to, just because the cost of capital is so much higher. So ultimately, yeah, Equity's been the one holding the bag. And if it's like, okay, we're underperforming, there's usually been a buyer that's willing to sort of overlook that. And I think just as interest rates go up and capital gets more expensive, people are maybe a little bit more judicious in that. Okay, so where's it going? As industries mature, you see different risks sort of, emerge, if I want to call it that. So again, we have one foot in both worlds, so let me take them in turn. On the production forecasting, and maybe I'll even call it tax structuring side, right? You always have tax equity in the mix. The other enabled feature of the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, is that you can transfer tax credits now, right? So now a solar project can both take the PTC instead of the ITC. Historically, that was only available for wind. And you don't even need tax equity. You could sell the tax credit functionally to a third-party buyer. And it's happened a couple times, I guess, so far. I think last year, billions of transfers is what I read, so maybe more than a couple times, but still a pretty nascent market. I think people are wondering how that's going to evolve. And on the whole, I don't think this would be a mischaracterization to say less sophisticated than the level of knowledge and competence that tax equity and debt has developed over the years, in particular tax equity, right?
Because that's they've had like 6 months to put it together. I don't know why they don't have it figured out by now, right?
Yeah.
It's new, right? It's new to our industry. New. People are figuring out. The buyers are still figuring out if it works for them. Yeah, I get it.
So there's a few things there. I mean, we're not active in this market, but we're seeing the tax insurance market really be robust, because as people are transferring tax credits, they want to make sure that any of that tax structuring risk is tailed off. If you're a corporate buyer and you're taking this and your solar is not your core business, you really don't want to have a recapture event or a whammy on your balance sheet because you got something wrong, right? We think that there's a production linked insurance, one of the things we sell, but we think that there's a role to play within the production tax credit market, especially because so much more of your revenues now are linked to production. You don't get the 30% tax equity takes right out of the gate. And then in the physical asset side, I mean, the conversation has been and continues to be anything, we call it NatCat, but natural catastrophe related. So the insurance markets, if you set aside renewables, are allergic is maybe too strong of a word, but highly scrutinizing of anything that has natural catastrophe exposure. Just way more expensive, way more managed than anything else. And solar has various forms. I mean, pretty much any physical asset does, but solar in particular, right? We build a lot in the Midwest, a lot in Texas, not so much in like along the coast, but still they get hit by hurricanes. So you sort of have to manage and appreciate, we could talk more about this, like how solar fits within an insurer's book and how they think about the risks that solar is exposed to vis-a-vis other risks. So I don't know, I think it's still evolving. Insurance we're seeing play more of a role. I think it's yet to be seen what these corporate buyers are really worried about and how they get structured within the deal.
So you talked some about the PTC, right? And have sort of touched on the financial risk that people have on the PTC, which is, well, what if it doesn't produce, right? And if you have a PTC plus you're transferring credits and you're expecting to get those, you know, what does that have, you know, how does that affect us? But that all relies on, and you slightly mentioned it earlier, the accuracy of those forecast estimates as a whole. And you mentioned earlier that you see that as changing. Can you dig into that a little bit more? Like, who's pushing on that change, and what, how do you see it changing? And do you see it, you know, significantly moving the needle in the industry, because it will take projects that are currently sitting in interconnection queues. When you change those forecasts, they may no longer be viable, right? So there's a real impact on the availability of overall projects out there. So understanding where that is going, you know, where is the forecast accuracy pushing the industry, I think is something that's really important. So dig into that a little bit more for me.
Let's
for everybody listening.
Yeah, no, let's maybe start with where I'll start with a little bit of historical context for just how these assets historically and still today get financed, right? As you build a financial model, we call it the pro forma model, your production basically drives everything in that number, in that model. So it, you know, drives your revenues, your EBITDA, everything else. It drives the size of your tax credit, sort of like the value of the asset from an appraiser, right? And it drives your debt service, so the size of your debt on top of that, right? So it's a pretty important figure that if you're not going to say people were doing this, but if you want to raise more capital, right, you sort of push that number up and more money materializes. In the production tax credit, right, sort of slightly different dynamic, right? You're selling the tax credit probably to a corporate or probably to a bank, but one or the other. They are trying to meet some sort of internal sustainability goals. They actually want you to generate, if you're underproducing, there's an issue. And also 100% of your capital now is linked to production, right? So just, it's become a lot more of an important factor, right, within the mix. The other thing that happens in PTCs is you're probably able to raise less capital because your PTC comes over 10 years versus your investment tax credit comes over the first year. So you're leaving more equity into the project, which again, now you're more sort of, your reliance on these cash flows is increasing.
Yeah.
So there's been some structural developments in the industry, I think, that have led, maybe I'll say the recipients of those production forecasts to insist upon more accuracy, maybe a neutral way to phrase that. But then also, as I mentioned, the IEs, those that are actually putting together the forecast, I think have more tools, more data, maybe a little bit more freedom to say, you know, we're trying to make them right-sized for what we're actually seeing happen in the field. So there's been, I think it's a positive development. I mean, there's some macro reasons why it's happening. There's probably some micro reasons why it's happening. But you know, one of the biggest risks to us as an industry is we bring in a lot of new capital and then we grossly underperform. And, you know, there's sort of a flight of capital. You know, I didn't actually plan to make this point at the time I said this statement, but I will make it anyway, which is we sort of saw that in the insurance market. If we sort of saw that in the insurance markets, we had a bunch of capital come in. We had some really big natural catastrophe losses and then a bunch of carriers pulled back and they said, this isn't quite what we thought. And we need to make sure we don't see that same thing happening on the asset investment side, the private equity capital is coming in to actually own these assets.
Yeah. You know, as a major input to that model, and we could go through and talk about shading and we could talk about all these other kind of inputs to how those models are developed. Yeah, but as a major, major one that I think we're seeing that's connected to what you're saying is weather models. Have you seen a different approach to applying weather models? Because on the one hand, you can make a statement, we've got more storms and all this other stuff, you know, if you believe in climate change and that sort of thing, you know, but the fact is the insurance companies have a lot of data that shows that that's the case.
Yep.
You know, we can all argue about the source and the why and whatever, but, you know, insurance companies will charge you with regardless of your opinion. So the weather input, but that weather input also drives much of the production expectations. I mean, it's solar, right? It's sun. It's based on how much sunshine you're getting, right? So are you seeing sort of behaviors around that weather model and standards around that weather model changing?
It's a good question. You know, one of the, I'll stick with the production side first, and then I'm keeping a foot in both worlds. So hopefully it's not confusing
sure.
you or the listeners, but you know, we sort of keep our feet in both worlds. So that's the way my mind works. On the production forecasting side, let's start there. You know, we have our own model that we use, which is how we underwrite the production for the insurance companies. Within our model, we use the same weather, the weather file company, let's call it that way. So we've sort of calibrated our models to a single source of satellite data that then we adjust and use all of our production data in our database to really calibrate against. You know, one of the ways that I guess you can adjust a production forecast from a third party or that we've seen happen is sort of cherry picking weather files, right? You can sort of negotiate a file and all there's, to your point, Mike, there's 50 assumptions, 100 assumptions that go into a model, but your weather file could be plus or minus 5%. That's a pretty big, or maybe more than that.
If not more.
Pretty big driver.
Yeah. You're minus 15, but it could be plus minus 5 in aggregate. Yeah.
Yeah, in aggregate. So I think we're seeing a little bit more judiciousness around that, right? Around using a weather file that might be more reflective. The other thing that I don't know if the industry's quite woken up to, although it's one that we pay a lot of attention to, is using a weather file for production forecasts and using a pyranometer in the field and then comparing those two and saying, hey, there's less sunlight than we expected. I mean, those are just sort of two totally different instruments with two totally different calibrations. And what our data science tell me is, like, if you're low weather for four quarters in a row, it's probably just that your pyranometer is reading different figures than your satellite data is. So there's also, I think, some maybe systemic reporting challenges of using two differently calibrated weather sources, right, on the production side. But I do think as an industry, sorry, long story short, that we're getting better at more judicious weather file selection. I hope so.
Yeah, I hope so. I will make a quick sort of comment on this one, which is that, you know, strictly speaking, climate is a longer term impact. We tend to look at these things as humans year to year because we're looking at financial returns. So we're looking quarter by quarter, year by year. But things like La Nina, El Nino are 4 and 5 year cycles. And so, you know, you're looking at a weather model and play it over 20 or 30 years. You can easily see 2 or 3 years of deviations from the weather without there being anything wrong with your pyranometers or your model, simply because you've got long cycle impacts. And that is true, particularly in the regions that we're growing the most in solar today, right? In the South, Texas through the Southeast. And so I don't know that we fully contemplate, you know, coming from an industry that started kind of in the deserts in the West where you don't have that, I'm not sure people really fully appreciate the multi-year nature and cycles of weather we're growing in today.
Yeah, the temporal element's a good point, because on the production underwriting side, I'll call it that, you take a really long view, right? You have production tax credits for 10 years, you have debt amortizing over, let's say, 12 years, you have an equity investor who's planning on a 30-year useful life. Compare and contrast that with the property insurance carriers who take a 1-year view, right? They care what's happening this year within the industry, within my book of business, and am I going to have a loss this year? And there's just sort of a, the weather models that you use for the physical asset side, the types of risks you're looking at, the timeframes you're concerned about, there is a tension there for sure.
Yeah. So you mentioned, and I agree with that, it's amazing. I've, you know, take it for what it's worth, I've seen insurance bills go up in bad year after bad years. I've never seen them go down after good years. That's so strange. Someday you'll have to explain that one to me, Jason.
They do, believe it or not. They call it hard cycles and soft cycles. Unfortunately, we're in a hard cycle right now.
I need to talk to a different insurance guy. Listen, you mentioned tax credit insurance. Yeah. I'm not familiar with that. I'm sure that a lot of the people listening or watching this aren't familiar. What the hell is that?
Good question.
I mean, I know what it says, but, like, how does it function and who's using those types of vehicles?
It's a good question.
Who's providing it?
It's a good question. So, you know, it's sort of an interesting risk as well that you can push into an insurance company. So it's written primarily by tax lawyers, actually, written by lawyers. So they're the underwriters on behalf of the carriers. And what they're saying is, if the structure of the deal, if maybe the basis within the deal that you're using for determining your investment tax credit, if any of that's challenged by the IRS, such that the tax credit is no longer valid, either it's valid but at a reduced amount, or there's some problem with the tax structure such that there's a recapture event or they try to claw it back, the carrier will come in and pay. So that's functionally what it's doing, is it's protecting the structure of the deal and even the basis within the deal, and sometimes the adders within the deal, the tax credit adders that the IRA had as well. So it's underwritten by tax lawyers. There's actually a pretty robust market of carriers that write it. It's not a market we're active in, but a pretty robust market of carriers that write it. And, you know, it's written sort of along with a different type of insurance. You could get reps and warrants insurance, believe it or not. So if you're doing, like, a, your private equity shop buying a company and you don't either believe that they're repping to everything correctly, representing all everything correctly, or there tends to be an error, So it sort of falls within a bucket of like professional liability. Some people might have heard of errors and omissions insurance. It kind of is related to that in some respects, that there's some problem with the deal such that, you know, the owner, the buyer of the tax credit would otherwise lose it. The carrier comes in and protects it.
So it's interesting. So we've talked for years about insuring production, mm-hmm. right? Sort of with like solar puts and things. And you guys have had products that you've offered around that. Mm-hmm. This is, instead of insuring the production, you're insuring the money from the production, which is kind of getting to the same thing.
You're not insuring that like the megawatt hour will be there, but you're insuring that if it's there and you're paying for it, that the IRS is going to give you the value for it.
Gotcha.
You know, okay. within, if I go back to like the start of our conversation, within risk allocation and risk identification, yeah. you can get pretty fine tooth comb about what specific risk are you worried about and then who are you going to pay to take it. So this falls within that bucket, right? You're sort of saying, even within a tax insurance policy, do I care about basis? Do I care about the structure? Do I care about the transfer element of the structure? Do I care about the adders? Like there's different things that you can cherry pick and say, do or don't care about it. And then they're going to charge you a different amount based off what you actually want to insure.
Yeah. Is that most easily carried on a single project level or on a portfolio? I would think a portfolio would allow a lower overall cost for that insurance just because of risk pooling. Or is it always written against an individual asset? It's per, you know, sort of financial,
I think,
reforms.
The theory you're saying is right, right? Which is insurance is big on risk diversification. It's typically this kind of insurance, the solar revenue put, typically done at the time of financing, right? It's when a new investor is coming in to make an investment and sort of a threshold item to say, will I invest in this asset or not? So functionally happens more at the asset level or more at the sort of financed portfolio level. Well, I'll call it more the financing level, whether that's a single sure. asset or a portfolio of assets, and less on sort of like someone's existing pool of assets.
So, given that that's the case for those large portfolio owners who happen to be listening to you and I gabbing at each other at some point, is there an opportunity to go back later once there's a portfolio in place and decrease that aggregate cost by looking at them in aggregate and going back to the insurance?
You know, typically I don't see it just because there's every portfolio tends to have a different investor with a different risk attitude.
Sure.
So you sort of design the insurance to what the particularities of that deal is. So I haven't personally seen it. Doesn't mean it's not happening.
I'd love to see. If somebody out there who's listening or watching this sees that going on, I'd love to know more too, because I think it's an interesting next opportunity that may be there to incrementally, you know, bend that curve. But of course, I could be wrong. This is not my area, Jason. This one's yours. So we talked a little bit about when we were prepping for this, like you used words like recapture risk and the intersection of that with physical risk. I have to be honest, when we were talking about it then, and as I look back over the notes, I wasn't really sure what that meant. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. There's a, within the investment tax credit, I'm getting pretty technical here. So,
that explains why I didn't understand it.
Project Finance 401 for our
yeah.
listeners. When you talk about the investment tax credit, it comes in at financing, right? So you get it right away, you take the tax credit on your tax form, whoever's taking the tax credit. But the IRS says, if anything happens to that asset for the next 5 years, we have the right to claw back all or a portion of that tax credit. And there's a couple provisions around when that clawback happens. One is a change of ownership, which I'm not going to really focus on today. But that leads to like back leverage and all the other financing structures, which is a whole different podcast. The other is the project comes out of service. So if you build the asset and a year later, for some reason, the asset's not operating, then you could lose your tax credit.
It's no longer delivering the value that the government invested in.
Correct. Right. They have a 5-year window for that.
Yeah.
Now, there's sort of this interesting thing. What if a hailstorm comes, destroys your asset, and you choose not to rebuild it, and that becomes a recapture event? There's sort of this interesting link between tax credit insurance and physical, I'll call it hail insurance or physical asset insurance. Because, you know, the hail, the insurance we write, which is more the physical asset insurance, will pay you for lost value. We'll pay you to typically rebuild it. But what's happening in the market today is there's such acute concentration of exposure for things like hail, right? $100 million solar asset might get $25 million of hail insurance. So there's sort of this, I'll call it a gap in cover that my understanding, again, don't quote me on this, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a tax insurer, but is that if you have a recapture because, let's say there's not enough property insurance to cover that rebuild, that tax insurance sort of synthetically covers some of that risk. So there's at least, at minimum, I'd say there's a linkage between what's happening to the asset on the ground, at least for those first 5 years, and what's happening with the tax insurance. I call it the same, right? If you have a PTC where you get 10 years of credits and you lose your asset in year three, like you don't have production for the next 7 years. So those are some of the, I'll call it more nuanced, but important risks. And within the financial investors we talk to, within the asset owners that we talk to, this idea of like how much physical risk insurance do I need? Am I able to get? Has become, I mean, sort of the reason we got into this business is some of the banks called me and they're like, this is becoming a top risk. Like there's not enough insurance out there that makes us comfortable for some of these assets. So it's become a highly negotiated point, some of these financings about the, again, this is more like the natural catastrophe insurance.
Yeah, that's an interesting gap that you mentioned. I mean, it occurs to me, you know, we're also dealing with an evolving regulatory framework, not just at a national level, but all the way down to the county, state and county level in many cases. And it could very well be that you build a site under one regulatory framework, you have a major catastrophic loss, and you can't rebuild it again because the regulatory framework no longer allows it, because you have to reapply for those permits and things right at that point in time. And so it's an interesting gap that you bring up that I had never considered. And I think it's one worth, you know, some of our listeners and folks really taking a hard look at in their portfolios, because I'm definitely seeing some communities in some areas, you know, evolve their view on permitting. And some of it's not in a positive direction, right, from a solar perspective. It's interesting. Yeah, certainly here in Texas, we've seen some bills and some things that were deliberately designed to accomplish that. And some of them almost passed. And so what that would do to try and rebuild an existing asset given a major loss is certainly an interesting thing to try to mitigate. So
it would be a big problem for all of us. On the insurance side, the two things that get covered predominantly are the value of the equipment that gets damaged, right? So you could rebuild it, and lost revenue, but typically up to a year, right? So a lot of it is what's the probability of that event occurring? And then if it occurs, what's the probability of a certain level of loss, right? And a certain level of downtime. And, you know, the things we care about are, can they rebuild it? That's certainly a thing that we care about. Can they get the supply, like, is the supply chain available? Are they able, do they have spare parts? And then just how's it designed? So we spend a lot of time thinking about resiliency, which is if that event comes, you know, you could do things to your site to make it less likely to break.
Which leads me directly into my next question. Thank you so much for that paragraph hook. You just did it for me. I think we should switch seats. So, you know, when we look at these sites and we look at their reliability over time, that ultimately is a function of the quality of the materials and the build, which I think more and more is starting to be considered by insurance companies. I think in the past, they looked at them as if they were all the same, and we all know that that's not true. So talk a little bit about insuring assets and is there a slider on the cost of insurance and whether you can even get it based on reliability, quality, build, when you contemplate these force majeure kind of events?
So I will say, unfortunately for most of the industry, still no. For us, yes, but we're the only underwriters that really come from the industry into insurance.
Yeah.
You still see a lot of, I'll call it like peanut butter pricing, for lack of a better word, but a certain price in Texas is sort of the price in Texas. What I sort of break, I'll call it now, I'm in the physical insurance world, the property insurance world, I sort of break it into three eras. So pre-2019, I'll call it the era of cheap and plentiful insurance. Wasn't really an issue. You ask people to get it, they buy it. 2019 to call it 2022-ish was a time of correction within a broader market that was challenging. So we had a big hail loss in 2019, sort of continued, honestly, through 2020, 2021. Yeah. You saw a big correction. You saw rates go up, as you said, Mike. You saw coverage get pulled back. You saw new terms and conditions entering the market, higher deductibles. The one that led to the call to me was the limits you could buy for these hazards were way reduced, right? So you used to get $100 million of insurance for a $100 million asset. You can't get that anymore. But the 2022 forward, this is sort of getting to your earlier question, I think is the era of resilience. I think we're still at the first inning of that era of resilience, but building and designing assets that are more likely to be able to withstand the events that really are happening. And I point to 2022 because that's when some of the initial research came out about hail. And I think RETC was at the front end of this, that if you tilt the module, you get a glancing blow and the glasses doesn't break as much. And that was the first of what has become a very robust set of research and industry practices about hail stow and auto hail stow and what tilt angle and well goes deep. But you know, insurance, like solar, not insurance, solar moves pretty fast. But the modules we're installing today are very different than the modules we're installing 15 years ago. Like they're rectangled, okay, and they have cells. But different glass, different frame thickness, different attachment methods, things that actually are important and lead to different drivers of loss when they're installed out in the field. So unless you're really intimate and you go to the conferences that I see you at and you're talking to asset owners all the time, it's easier, I say, just to give a peanut butter rate. So we see a lot of people do that. Doesn't mean you're going to get the right answer, though.
So if you don't have a great asset, maybe go for the peanut butter rate. If you've got a quality asset, call up Kilowatt Hour Analytics. You may get a better rate.
Yeah, ask for a quote. That's right. Ask your broker. But I think as we get smarter as owner operators and as the brokers get smarter and as the carriers get smarter, you're going to see a trend towards that. It's just we're still in the very early days of that. And a lot of the market's not caught up yet.
So if I was to think about this whole conversation and summarize it, I would say that insurance and a lot of the issues that we've seen in these vehicles that are out there that help us to manage risk and sort of the push and pull on the balloon or the toothpaste is largely resulting in an overall industry move towards quality, reliability, transferability of the financial benefits and being able to make sure that we really know what these things are going to do over time. And I have to think that that's good overall, however painful it may be.
I think so. As an industry, we've been very good at cost reduction.
Yeah.
I think. And, there's a floor on that. No one really likes to admit it, but there's a floor on that. And we're now, I think, in a time when maybe it makes sense to pay a little bit more upfront, but to get sort of lower LCOE or better risk-adjusted returns on the whole. It's a more sophisticated way, a more nuanced way of thinking about things than just dollar per watt. But I agree with you. On the whole, better quality assets should lead to better quality financing, better quality results for everyone involved.
Hey, build a better project, get lower insurance, better financing, less risk, get a good O&M operator, you got better production. Who would have thought, right?
Yeah, it sounds obvious.
It sounds obvious when you say it like, yeah. So Look, just before we, sort of sign off and leave people with all the questions that I'm sure they have for this conversation, any final thoughts you have or any sort of things out there you want to just bring to people's attention?
Good question. The open-ended question at the end I should have prepared for.
Sorry about that. I wasn't meaning to put you on the spot, although that is
my job. I mean, look, I think I touched on this. I think the thing that I always have to remind myself is when you look at the growth forecast for us as an industry, we're supposed to double the amount of solar in the ground in the next 5 years, right? Everything in my career, I've been in this industry 15 years, whatever we built is going to double in the next 5 years and probably double again after that.
And yeah, every 5 years, they say the same thing. Yes.
Yeah. If we want to meet our goal, the $2 trillion of investment globally, some of that includes transmission, but $2 trillion globally of investment required. So, yes, there's a lot of assets in the ground, but there's a lot of growth to come. Like, the more we can educate, the more we can refine, the better, I think, right? So, like, it's great you do this podcast, Mike. It's great that there's other thought leaders out there. Like, we have a lot of new people we need to recruit and educate about the risks in the segment. And it's going to be exciting. So I don't know. I think that there's a lot of excitement to come. And honestly, a lot of things we've learned, I want to make sure as an industry, we avoid the same mistakes we've made in the past, but that we're able to build, operate, you know, finance and support resilient assets, reliable assets, and high quality assets.
Fantastic. Well, I mean, I say this all the time, but I'll say it again. You know, Jason, you are indeed a power player. Kilowatt Hour Analytics is a great company. I've enjoyed many years of association, long conversations, some over drinks with you guys. And I hope that everybody else has the opportunity to reach out to y'all and get that same experience. Because I got to tell you, I really appreciate everything you do and your company does in the marketplace. And this has been a great episode. I've learned a lot. I hope everybody else has. Thank you for joining Power Players today.
Thank you, Mike. Comments are echoed and appreciate you having me.
Absolutely. Talk to you later, Jason.
All right, take care.
Find summary thoughts on this topic and more insights into operating your clean energy assets at OrigisServices.com. Thank you for listening to this episode of Power Players by Origis, critical thinking to deliver the clean energy promise.